Welcome to the Apparel Entrepreneurship Podcast. We are your hosts, Anne and Klaus Christensen, founders of Apparel Entrepreneurship, your go-to source for running and growing a successful, meaningful apparel brand. Each episode will give you hands-on tactics and practical strategies about everything apparel entrepreneurship. You'll also hear inspiring conversation with apparel industry experts and entrepreneurs about their tips and journeys in this fast-paced industry. Today, we're super excited to have Pascal Moreau on as a guest on the Apparel Entrepreneurship Podcast. And I think you and I met the first time in last November, correct?
Yes.
At the Textile Bureaus Days, we were on the same panel. And I was completely amazed by your intelligence, by your knowledge, your skill, and just how you behaved and how you answered the questions from the public, and just your enormous, just your enormous knowledge in the industry. And of course, right now we are in a shift. It's been, everybody and all the brands are working on sustainability, and now a lot of brands are implementing circularity. But of course, now we also have legislation and we also have regulations coming. So this is going to be today's topic. First of all, can you please introduce yourself and tell us what you do, where you are, what's going on, and why we're having this conversation today?
Yay. Thank you so much for the invitation and the very kind words. I must say it was super nice to meet you in Sweden back in November. I was amazed by your energy on scene, on stage, and during the dinner, also like super nice conversation. As you can hear, I'm French, got a little accent here, but I lived around the EU. I'm the founder of OANA Public Affairs, and it's a small consultancy in Brussels, and that actually digging into all the EU legislation, as Anna was mentioning, and we help our clients to understand what's going on and to navigate the new landscape. And we have a massive footprint in the textile industry. So that's why I'm here, because we are one of the few public affairs consultancies so specialized in the textile industry, in a nutshell.
With our clients at Descender, we see this constantly, that they know the legislation's coming, but they don't know what to do. So most of them are running around like chicken without heads and don't know what direction to go in. So that's why we thought this conversation today is really, really important, just to help people know where to go and what to do and what it's about and why is it coming? What's the problem? What's the effect it's going to have on your business, no matter if you're a startup, if you're a mid-sized brand, or if you're a multi-billion dollar corporation.
Yeah.
But first of all, why did you pick this industry? Why are you doing what you're doing?
I think actually the industry picked me. I was, so context a bit, I was in Amsterdam back in the days, and more in the ICT industry and healthcare industry. And then I was in big corporations, and I wanted to go into a small organization. And then the SAC, the Sustainable Apparel Coalition, opened their office in Amsterdam when I was looking at that change. And it was 10 years ago now. I just realized that when preparing the podcast, not getting any younger.
Time flies.
And actually, it was the moment where all those discussions on sustainability and textile and the EU were starting, really at the very infancy of it. And it's one of the last sector that has been regulated on sustainability. So being part of really the last decade journey, that's why I'm saying the industry picked me, because you've come from the really initial discussion to actually the legislation now and starting helping companies to implement and think of, okay, what are the actual changes? And that's why I really liked the opportunity and staying there. In the industry. So it's exciting, to say the least.
And also, it's so complex and it's so deep. Of course, it's wide as well, where there's so many parameters, but not very many people kind of dare to go into this segment and kind of niche down, because it's so, you need to have a lot of different hats to be able to consult in this area. You need to understand the full supply chain. You need to understand business operations from a company perspective. What does it take inside of the businesses, but also what does it take after you leave the tech pack to the supply chain? And where does the material come from? And then what happens afterwards with, you know, marketing and the greenwashing and all the chemicals and all the, it's just so complex. That's why you're going to put clarity to it today.
And then coming back on that, I think it's what also I've been lucky to have time within the SAC before being a consultant to really understand the supply chain. Also with the clients we have, it's they're actually taking the time to explain us what are the difficulties, what is the reality. So you can really also bring that knowledge to policymakers, because otherwise they don't know what is happening. They don't know the reality of the industry. And they think, we regulated phones, right? The same, more or less the same supply chain. And you're like, well, not really. Like, it's different, really different. And then they're like, oh, okay. And so that's, I think, indeed, for what you're saying, you need to understand the industry, and then you can actually do a good job to explain it to policymakers, and so that the law actually nail it and really drive change. Yeah.
So all this change that's coming now and all the legislations, why is this so important right now that we pay attention to this? Where are we now in the industry and why is it an urgency?
Yeah. So there are like several factors, I would say. First is it's never been as an industry, any industry, we are the only ones that is getting all the changes at once. So now really, you can really say sustainability is being regulated. Whereas all the other industries, it started with waste, with chemicals, you know, bits and pieces. Whereas for us, it's like, you want it, well, then you get it. It's like, bam, it's the full thing. So some people are talking about avalanche or tsunami, and others are telling me like, yeah, that's really negative, you know, wording. Should we say like we're actually putting the foundation and the floor for our industry to actually raise the bar, creating the leveling playing field, and then we can go up and, you know, create the house and create those initiatives. So for me, it's like coming back to your question, I think we are laying down the foundation for our sustainability, for our industry, and that the foundations are really important. It's also key because if you don't comply with the legislation, you will not have access to the EU market. Meaning, as a business, you cannot sell your products in the EU. So you're basically losing business. So,
and this is really important because our listeners and our clients are from all over the world, no matter if they're, again, if they're a startup or if they're a full-blown mega brand. So this is really crucial.
Yeah.
You want to have access to the European market in the future and from now on, you really have to pay attention to these legislations, right?
Exactly. It's kind of what I used to say in, in speeches and talks, it's the new license to operate. So if you don't know, you basically will be out of business as from, let's say, 2028. So it's around the corner when you think of design cycles and also the time to shift internal systems to gather information and everything. What it's also important to note is that when we think EU legislation, we think, okay, it's for EU brands. You know, it's not for the rest of the supply chain or the other non-EU organization. Well, they need to wake up because it's actually going to impact them.
So basically, let's say you have a brand based in the US and you have your production in Asia and you're a D2C brand, you will not be able to sell to the EU D2C.
Yeah, exactly. So that's, and also for, above all, when it comes to product, so some pieces of legislation will not apply to you depending on, you know, thresholds of turnovers, employee, et cetera. But I think the key one that you need to think of, and as was one of the points we wanted to discuss, but it's the eco-design legislation. So how to design your product to reduce the environmental impact. And that, for that, it's a It's a piece of legislation that if you don't comply with it, you will not, your product will not enter the EU market, meaning you cannot sell them. And for me, it's the piece of legislation you have. It should be the key priority at the moment. So, yeah.
So before we continue, how many legislations are we talking about? How many are in place now and how many do we have to look forward to, roughly?
Look forward to.
Let's have fun. There's the number of 16 legislation.
In place right now or upcoming?
No, upcoming. So wait, can I share my screen? Is it?
You should be able. Let's see. Try and just click on the share.
It's you. So you should be able to see it.
Yes, this is fantastic.
Yes.
Wait, I'm putting in bigger so you can actually. Oh,
yeah, no. There we go.
Perfect.
Okay. This is awesome.
So it's basically you have more than 16. Usually how I do it is that I divide it into buckets. So company, product, and consumer communication. Company level, you have three. And the key ones at the moment are due diligence and reporting. The reporting directive is actually already in place. But it's only for bigger organizations. And then due diligence is just being approved at the moment. And so companies will have to dig into that. And there will be guidelines for our own sectors. So explaining in more details what it means for the textile industry. And that will start being developed as from spring. So let's say after May, and after the EU elections. And then you have the product part, which is really where it's what we call access to market legislation. So if you don't comply, your products should not be on the market and the customer will not be allowed to buy them. So it's what we call the eco-design. So you might see ESPR somewhere on internet is basically the abbreviation of the eco-design legislation. And the eco-design legislation puts requirements on product performance. So what we were saying, and I can go into more details after that, like how good your products need to be when it comes to recycled content, durability, recyclability, chemicals, you name it. And it's linked to here to the digital product passport, and also happy to go into that.
Yeah, I want to talk more about that later.
Yeah.
And then you have, I would say, all the chemicals restrictions and the big one on forced labor regulation. There is one piece of legislation in the US about it. Here in EU, it's a bit different because we like making things differently. And it's for all products from all regions of the world. So it's not targeted to a certain region or certain countries. And in the US, you really have to showcase that your products is not using forced labor in the manufacturing part, like supply chain level. And then there will be the waste framework directive. That is also something coming up. And then all the communication. So as a company, when you do want to do marketing and reach out to your end users or consumer, you must substantiate your claims. So now you cannot just say, I don't know, this scarf is really nice, got, I don't know, like we reduce the environmental impact by whatever percentages. You will have to showcase to a customer and to the authorities why you can say that. So you will have to have the data. You have to traceability. It will be key to be able to do that. So just high level, those are the key ones to take into account.
And what's the time frame for this? What time are we talking about? When does all this need to be implemented?
Yeah, it's about, do I have it here? Yep. Wait, it's this one. I would say it's 2000. I don't want to go into the super detailed of these slides, but AIM 2027 and 2028. So that's where most of the key legislation will apply. They're not going to apply all at the same time. But the big shift, as you were saying, Anna, at the very beginning of our conversation, it's 2027, 2028, meaning that you need to start investigating now and understanding the pieces of legislation, because at the end, you only have 3 to 4 years to really do that change. And the pieces of legislation that you will have to comply with are actually being published at the moment. So it takes some time to understand what you need to do and actually to implement those changes.
And which ones are the most important or the most crucial? Because you mentioned, of course, that everything comes at once, but where should companies start? Let's say, no matter if you're a startup or if you're an existing brand, where do you start?
I would say the key ones, it's eco-design, to be honest, this one, because otherwise you would not be able to do anything. And then EU forced labor, it's going to be published next month, because they're voting on it next week. Those are the big ones with due diligence, because otherwise you would not be able to comply.
So in short, what do these mean?
Thanks for redirecting me. I get overexcited with that.
There's so much. I just want to break it down and really understand.
You're right.
It sounds so overwhelming.
It is overwhelming. For me, what you need to do as a company internally is you need to understand that you will have to change the way you measure durability, recyclability, and you will need to gather inputs from like data or proof that you comply. So as a company, you need to create a traceability strategy and traceability way of gathering data, because it's going to help you show compliance, and it's going to also make sure that you can input all the information in the digital product passport. So the foundation is making sure you have the data and you have the information. And that data, you will need to look into each legislation saying like, okay, because I'm this size, let's say you're a really small organization, then due diligence reporting directive doesn't apply to you. So you're like, okay, I'm going to focus on eco-design and forced labor, because that's really what I, as a small company, need to comply with first to make a business. And then you will, so like, what does it mean is ensuring from a standards perspective that your product, if you do the final product, that on durability, you have the right specification, recycled content. For example, if you're a designer, you're like, okay, then you have additional rules to your work. You might have the feeling it's stop your creativity, but you will need to take into account that, okay, I need to achieve for, I don't know, again, this weather, that I need to achieve 20% recycled content. I'm inventing the number. It's not what it's in the law. We actually don't know. But that would be, you know, like, okay, I have an extra goal to the original goal that I have. I'm not sure if it's clear, or do you want me to re-explain?
It's good.
And then that, I would say that data, if you also want to communicate to your own customer, so consumers like end users, it would be also key, because when it comes to marketing claims, you would have to have that data. You have to have those proof to say like, yes, my product is very much is better than what my competitors are putting on the market. And that's why you need to come to me and buy it through me. And I'm saying like, you need to look into which data you need to gather as a first step.
How do you get this data and where do you put it? Like, how do you just physically, of course, you can discuss with all the contact points in your supply chain, trying to understand tier one, tier two, tier three, all the subcontractors, all the, you know, try to go as deep as possible, have nominated suppliers, etc. You can't always really have full coverage of that. So that would mean that as a brand, you would totally have to potentially even work with new suppliers or manufacturers that want to be transparent, that kind of give you all the information because they know of the legislation that's coming, instead of finding someone on Google and then sending them a shitty tech pack and then hoping, you know, they give you the best product ever. You have no idea what's in it. But I'm thinking, again, how do you, will there be lists with questions or information? Like, where do brands go to know exactly what data points to get, and where do they actually put this data, and how? Is it an Excel list? Is it like, what do they do with it?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and it's still up in the air.
So,
yeah. For example, on eco-design legislation, we have the overall framework that applies to all industries. And now the commission is with the industry defining exactly what recyclability means, what durability means. So we are in the process of defining that. So I cannot tell you, because we are defining that, I cannot tell you what to look for.
And yes.
It's kind of catch 22, you know, like, yep, a chicken and egg story. But we should have a better understanding by the end of this year, what kind of data you need and standards you need to look into and to gather the info. When it comes to where to get the info, like how to consolidate the information, the digital product passport is kind of seen as the magic wand by the European Commission, of the tool where everybody will be able to put info.
Explain a little bit deeper. Will there be like a website? Is it a product? Is it a work tool? What is it actually? Is it a website you go to and fill the information or register your brand? Like, logistically, if I'm a brand, how the hell do I do this?
Yeah. I thought I had this in my slide. I'm just trying to find one.
I'm just thinking about, you asked about where all the information should come from. This must be a real good advantage for suppliers and manufacturers to be proactive and start putting all this information, making it easy for brands to work with them, for those who want to make business in Europe, in the upcoming years, to have the information ready as a package. They know what the brands will need. And if they don't have that, the brands are probably going to start looking for other suppliers. And right, if it's too cumbersome to retrieve this information, well, it's going to take them too much time. So they're going to start looking elsewhere.
Yeah, no, definitely. It's when I talk to manufacturers, usually, or like either manufacturers or, for example, brands, smaller brands that might not be, so UK brands, for example, that are not big enough to comply with, for example, due diligence or others. But if they want to remain in the market, they will have to answer questions from big retailers that need to comply. And same for manufacturers. So there is a ripple effect of this legislation that, unfortunately, I would say our industry was not good at talking about, and giving heads up to non-EU actors. So manufacturers, but also smaller brands outside of the EU. And from a business perspective, it's a massive business opportunity for them to know what the legislation is about, because then they can make sure themselves, they understand the legislation, they comply with the legislation as much as they can. So they are like, I don't know, materials providers. Then they will be like, okay, we know that recycled content is coming, that durability standards are coming. Then I need to ensure that whatever I'm doing with my material, the material I'm created, actually comply with those standards. And if they do not comply, then they will not be able to sell to EU brands. And then you lose that massive market, basically, in your business. And that's something I think we really, we are getting there for the past 2 years. Transformers Foundation, I don't know if you heard about them. They kind of raise awareness through an open source information to list off the legislation, what it means for suppliers and everything.
We can have the links later in the show notes.
Yeah. And it's a bit like what it's difficult. It's patchy. So manufacturers, non-EU actors need to understand where to get the information because you don't have like one website that, you know, encompass everything.
And this is the problem. There's like, and this is also one of my questions. Did you find the answer on the, or the, on the digital product passport?
I do have it. Do you want to do that?
Just briefly, I'm thinking this digital product passport. So it will be a passport per product, per style for a brand. Is that how it works? So this passport will show that you comply to the legislations, basically.
Maybe this is, let's dive in into that right now, into this topic. Let's go deep.
We can go on all topics, but okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So digital product passports, it's one part, if I go back to the basic of what it is, it's one part of the eco-design regulation. So when you think digital product passport, if you want to have more information about it, don't look for digital product passport legislation. You will not find it. You need to go into the eco-design legislation. So it will be a digital information tool with the objective to capture all the information needed to showcase that your product comply with the performance requirements, but also the information requirements. So it's kind of like a big hub of where you could input your information. Important to note that the commission doesn't want to create a master, like gigantic tool where everybody uploads their information. They want to create more connections between existing databases so that we don't recreate the wheel, basically. Exactly how it will work, we are still working on that. But that's the idea, is that how the commission usually describe it is when you look at a big building, you know, like at night, sometimes you see some windows that have lights and others are switched off. So then basically everybody would put the data, but then for example, the end user, so consumer like you and me, will only have access to, I don't know, the window that it's with has a red light on the first floor, on the fourth floor, and on the eighth floor. Whereas the authorities, so to check if your product is compliant, will have access to basically all the windows with all the lights on. And then your the recyclers, so those that are that need the information to ensure that it's the products are reused, recycled, you know, the end of life as approach, and to reclose the loop, they will have access to the windows with blue light on, I don't know, second floor, sixth floor, ninth floor, you name it. And then the different value chain actors will be able to input wherever actually they have access with the badge to the building. So that's a bit the approach, if you want to explain it in a way. Yeah.
And how is it applied physically, or how will this work from a brand and consumer perspective?
Let me see if I can answer that question with the. So you should be able this, and that's high level how they want to do it. So coming back to your question at one point, if it was at, you know, SKU level, or at which level of product we want to have the information, that's still under discussion. So it's going to be either at model or at batch or at like individual item. So that's still in discussion. But what it's important from coming back to hands-on, what we need, we need to have unique identifier for per product, but also for per facilities, so factories, so that you can really link the information to the product and ensure you have like full traceability. And that's something in our industry we don't have. I know there are lots of conversation about it for quite some years actually, but the digital product passport will really push for that to find a solution on this. So it's easier also to gather data. The data carrier, so let's say a QR code, we need to be
on the label, for example, on the care label, for example, or the hang tag,
so that we can, so custom authorities can check, for example, scan and say like, okay, this product is fine, and have, you know, like those windows, they will have access to certain windows. And then for consumers, when they either buy it in the shop or online, they actually can have access to this level of information. So website and data carrier. So it's actually a massive data exercise. There are some questions on...
Because all this seems from an operational perspective like a massive investment. I'm not only talking by time for the team to actually get the data, but of course it will be systems, it will be the extra care labels, the extra getting the information. What are we looking at in terms of investment? Is this being taken in consideration? Do we know the effects this is going to have on brands?
I don't know the numbers, you know, like saying how much you need to invest. But when it comes to human resources, for example, most of the biggest brands have now traceability teams. They didn't have that a few years back. For example, a friend of mine joined one of the big companies and now she's head of traceability there. And it was like not even like the past 3 years. It's a lot of investigation also and collaboration with manufacturers. So a lot of your production strategy will also have to include traceability strategy. So how your portal and IT portal can talk to each other. So coming back to the example of, is it an Excel file? Then you will have to invest in IT systems. There are lots of now service providers that are going into that that directions to provide solutions. So you need to talk to them. I would be really cautious when service providers, and that's for, you know, all legislation, not only for digital product passport, but any service providers that tell you that if you use their services, you will be compliant. It's a bit greenwashing or compliance washing, because you will have to do the job. It's not just by implementing their things that you will be 100% compliant like this. There will be a massive work behind to be done.
I'm thinking, but besides the labor and the systems, do we know if there are going to be any fees for certifications or similar that you will have to pay for in order to be compliant?
Well, you will have to, for example, you will have to look into certifications that do comply. Some of the pieces of legislation put a framework for certification bodies. So labeling bodies, for example, recycled content and those kind of things. So you will have to ask them, do you comply with those guys? And then it would be easier for you to say like, okay, I used that certification it's compliant with the requirements. They have those checks themselves. They have verifiers, blah, blah, blah. Then I can use this certification. And if I put it forward, I've got higher chances to be compliant.
But it will not cost more to actually implement, for example, the digital product passport like it does, like it costs to actually have certifications. So there's no...
It will cost more because you will have to have potentially an IT system and you might want to have additional certification that above all for a smaller business that you didn't have before.
Yeah.
I think the bigger businesses, they have tons of certifications. They might want to rethink which certification they are using because of requirements. But there will be some shifts. I think some certification will drop because they do not comply, or they will have to do a massive investment to change the way of working. But for smaller organization, I feel it might be a big cost that is coming.
Do we know anything about the non-compliance costs? I know, for example, in EU, we have these data legislations like GDPR. Yeah. And if you don't comply to those, you can look at really hefty fines. Have there been any discussions about, let's say, a DTC brand and you slip away a couple of orders to the EU when you're not compliant? Do we know anything about that?
I come from a lawyer family, so...
Okay, okay, you can't say much about that. But no, do we know anything yet about... have you been talking about fines and...
No, I was joking, but I think some companies will try to do that because the checks at customs will have to be done by competent authorities, so by national authorities. And they still need to get the knowledge on our industry, how to check the products, what does it mean to be compliant, not compliant. So I feel some of the organizations that are not really sustainability driven or don't want, you know, like not leaders, they will say like, we'll go through, you know, like we will try to go through the nets and let's see how it happens.
And basically, it's cheaper to pay the fine than to actually do and implement the work. Is that where you're the angle?
I don't think so, because then you will have, for example, eco-design legislation. You will have to withdraw all your products from the EU market.
So they will shut you down, basically, in the EU.
Yeah.
So that's the penalty.
Exactly.
All right.
And then, for example, for marketing, so...
Greenwashing,
and not so mark. Yeah, sustainability communication not according to the law. Then you will have some fees, and depending on each country, so it's at national level that they are putting. But it's 4% of your turnover, if I'm not mistaken, 4 or 5.
Ouch.
Yeah.
And
that's a lot.
And then if you're a smaller organization, for example, or more workwear. Then you would not be able to apply for funds, and you would not also be able to compete in a public procurement. So that's also, you know,
shut down. That's okay. So basically, just do what the law says if you want to operate. Period. I have a second question on top of the payment and. I'm curious to hear your opinion because, of course, prices will potentially go up. Everybody in their own businesses will have to increase teamwork, tools, etc. Who do you think in the end, because usually how this industry works is that the lower down on the food chain you are, it's the ones that pay the price. It's not the consumer, because the consumer, according to brands, the consumer doesn't want to pay more. So we push the manufacturers, we push the suppliers, literally we push everybody fighting for cents. Will there be any regulations into who will need to take the bill?
Yes.
Will the brands take the bill, or will, as usual, the manufacturers and the suppliers take the bill?
Yeah, so really good question. There is no pieces of legislation on that.
Can we put that on the list to discuss at the legislature level?
There is, in the due diligence, there are some, so due diligence pieces of legislation exist in France and Germany, but now that you have an EU one, and the overall like philosophy of the law is to, is to look into your full supply chain and analyze the risks and to mitigate, identify, mitigate those risks. And one of the risks that is identified in the law, like listed in the law, is actually purchasing practices. So after it's basically based on your metrics, you if you decide that purchasing practices is a risk, then you will have to work on it. But there is no pieces of legislation on purchasing practices. Having said that, civil society is looking into it. They've been pushing for that. For me, the next, this, say, flow of legislation has been very much on circularity, greenwashing, because the EU Green Deal has been to push for carbon neutrality, and circularity is one of the tools to get there. So that's why we are pushing into that. But all social aspects has been a bit less intense. So we have due diligence, we have forced labor, but purchasing practices is not actually addressed. And it's been really a huge call from civil society to say, we are missing something. We need to work on it. So it might be the next move, maybe not with the next mandate of the commission. So after the elections in June, so don't forget to go and vote. It's the first week of June. Then there will be like a new kind of new strategy, new priorities, and we do not expect sustainability to be super high on the agenda. So new pieces of legislation, and so we might need to wait a bit for purchasing practices. But we do know that they did that for agri-food industry, so there is kind of a blueprint that does exist. And let's see if they can replicate that for the textile industry.
Definitely hoping so.
Yeah.
One question about these legislations. How big part of them will be about the information, the traceability, knowing where it's coming from, and how much will be about the actual products that they're conforming with certain type of contents in the materials and so forth?
Yeah.
Where are we now?
Yeah. So when it comes to information and gathering information, when I talk to clients and I'm like, okay, those are all the legislation, and they're like, okay, how do we drive that? You know, what kind of working groups we are putting together internally? So you have like some on products, because on eco-design, some on supply chain, some on orders. But there is one that is always horizontal, is data collection. So all our clients are like, okay, traceability, data, whatever legislation we are looking into, we need to have a core group that is looking into that and is connecting the dots between the legislation, because they're all at the end, one way or another, connected. So if you want to comply with, let's say, green claims, green, like anti-greenwashing legislation, you need to think of, okay, like what is happening in eco-design? So that's one part of the piece of your question. The other parts were like, which one are really looking into pure product? So eco-design, like it will really give you the framework from designers, from purchasing department, marketing also. Like, okay, what can we say and what cannot say? Because so eco-design is the baseline. Again, mm-hmm. we love having floors in this house.
Yes, yeah. In the EU. Logical steps.
Yeah, I like that.
So like eco-design, if you like, you cannot enter the market if you don't put that floor. And then if you want to do marketing, you need to be better. You need your products need to be better than that baseline. So you need to, let's say, build the first floor. Let's say ESPR is the ground floor of your house, and then marketing would be the first floor. So you have to increase your performance specification to be able to do some marketing. So there is like those two steps that you need to think of. So let's say by law, all products need to be to have 20% recycled content. I keep with that example. It's just an example. Please do not freak out, everyone. It's not what's in the law. But let's say, and you want to showcase that your product is really good, then you will have to have at least 21% as a bare minimum. I would say even like more, because otherwise it's really limit, like really greenwashing to the limit. But that's how I would say how, from a product perspective, it's linked, from a design also. Yeah.
And back to some tactical word. I'm a brand. I hear this interview. I freak out. Where exactly do I go to get, where do I go?
Yeah. So a lot of them are using national association or subsector association. So for example, the outdoor industry, you have the European Outdoor Group that is doing an amazing job to help you understand the pieces of legislation. I'm also selling myself a bit here because we work with them with the webinars, but they also...
That's why you're here, because we want people to come to you because you will sort their stuff out.
Yeah. And then they're also looking into partnering also EOG, the European Outdoor Group, sorry, partnering with someone that knows how to implement legislation. So trying to look into tools and guidelines or what are the first steps, like really like hands-on guidelines. I know they are looking into that when it's going to be available, that it's to be defined, but we understood that was the need from the industry.
And if you're a fashion business and not so much in the outdoor or sports world?
I know the Danish, if you're Danish, the Danish industry is looking into that, so DMT. Otherwise, I would say Sustainable Apparel Coalition.
Yeah.
There's not that one-stop shop as EOG has or trying to, you know, like, sorry, develop. So you will have to look either at a national organization or at, I would say, Cascale. Now that it's not SAC, it's Cascale now. They are looking into tools also to help you on that. Wordly also, I know they are looking into like e-learning tools.
The Higg Index.
Exactly. So, but it's all, a lot are still in process because the pieces of legislation has just been approved. So you might need to wait like a few months so that everything is ready, maybe September or something. But that the complexity is that you don't have a one-stop shop of explaining the law and getting hands-on guidelines. We are working on it, but again, we are like one small piece, happy for everybody to come to us. But they're like...
We'll put all the links in the notes.
But the industry is not set up to actually help everyone. And I think that if I would be top leaders in the industry, it's something that you want to achieve and you want to create.
I want to talk about innovation because these are limitations for companies. You would see you're putting them in a box, right? If you're a designer, again, you might freak out. Oh, then I don't have the entire toolbox. I only have this tiny, tiny toolbox. Where does innovation come in and how can brands still keep innovating within the frames?
Yeah, indeed. It's been the big question mark from everyone. There's an ask to from the industry to the EU to actually help funding innovation or the infrastructure also, because we are talking about recycled content, we are talking about textile to textile. So there is some need for innovation, definitely. But the issue with legislation at the moment is that everybody will focus on compliance and kind of forget innovation. And when I talk to sustainability peers or experts, they are like, oh my God, this is going to be boring. as a job. We're just going to comply for the next 5 years, and then we'll be able to go into innovation. I think it will have to be a phase we'll have to deal with, unfortunately. But then once everybody is at par, then innovation would be like, okay, the race is back on. There are some discussion within the commission to continue that there are some programs and stuff when it comes to innovation. When I see the big guys, and it might be more complicated for SMEs, but the big guys are still investing. They're like, okay, recycle content, we need to find a solution. Renewcell didn't go through, but then you have other announcements of, you know, new ventures, new ideas. I think this will continue because we'll have to reach higher level of recycled content. So what are the next innovation? What is it, chemical recycling? Is it, you know, like, how can we improve textile recycling? This is going to be the new race for innovation. You will have to invest into that and to make sure that you also share it with the industry.
Because this industry is not always so sharing friendly, as we know, brands tend to keep to themselves. If you're part of groups, then it's easier because you have leadership talking to each other on completely different levels. But in general, the fashion industry, if they find something awesome, they keep it to themselves. So it's not a very open communication conversation. It's not, let's help each other to bring this industry forward. It's more like kind of everybody's dealing with their own stuff. So how do you think, is anything in the legislations going to attack this fact to force all the different entities and operations to collaborate? Or will it be, let's hope so, but nothing's going to be kind of set in stone?
The legislation is not telling you have to be friends with your neighbors and collaborate with them. But by the framework, you will have to do it. Like digital product passport, if you want to comply as a brand, then you need to work with your suppliers and service providers. It's so complex that you have to talk to each other. Like big brands need to talk to each other. You cannot solve the whole compliance and innovation alone. So it's a mental shift that you will have to do. I think what it's coming with legislation is not only compliance, but it's really a shift of how we envision sustainability in our industry. That's really it's a new era that we are seeing coming, really.
Which is good because you can never do and implement big change alone. And of course, the product is not the product. You don't only invent and birth the product, but the product does something. It takes a life of its own afterwards. The customer buys it. The customer wears it afterwards. What do I do with it? Do I resell it? Do I give it away to someone else? Do I toss it? I want to, you know, recycle it. Where do I go? So thinking about the entire circularity aspect, how is the legislation going to affect that? Because now we want to be thinking from a product, from a circular model, and with other secondary business models, for example, the resale, the rental, the subscription models, the recycling eventually down the line. How is that going to play into this?
I think to close the loop, the legislation did really well on the products, really well. Let's see when it's implemented. But it is pushing toward that at really pure product level. So, you know, recycled content, blah, blah, blah. When it comes to shifting from a linear business model to a circular business model, for me, that's where there is a huge loophole, like opportunity. They think by, you know, putting requirements at product level, it will actually ensure we close the loop. But we all know this is not what is happening.
No.
So there is no pieces of legislation or looking into, for example, VAT, lowering the VAT for, secondhand business models. Those kind of things, like the whole financial part, pure business part of circular business model has been overlooked. And one of the reasons is because it's national legislation, it's not EU legislation. So as EU authorities, they cannot tell France or Sweden or Belgium to say, like, you have to change, you have to reduce the VAT. And that's why it's the missing part and the big one, because we all know that circular business model is, yes, it's great, but then you need to educate consumers because you still have, we sometimes still want to have our own new product. And you will have also to make sure that actually they are financially viable. Because when you look at big companies or smaller companies, it's complicated to make sure that they actually make money out of it. A friend of mine has set up her own small company for based on, you know, reusing textile or like fabrics that were not used by bigger organization. Then she's like, yeah, it's great, but I'm not making money out of it. So how are you, you know, like helping those businesses? And I think that's where from a smaller organization, the big ones will be able, because they have the compliance team, they have also the finance to put money into circular business models. But smaller organization, I fear that could be tricky for them because of the legislation upcoming.
And going into the education, which was one of my other like big question marks, who's going to be responsible for this? Is there a plan in place? Because of course, brands will have to educate the customers somehow, because there's going to be changes, potential price increases, why they did all the changes without greenwashing. But I know UK a couple of years back, they did a push on health. So they, like, from the country itself, they did a national campaign on why people should exercise and why, etc. Will there be any push from the European Union, any support to the individual countries to actually educate? Who's going to, you mentioned education, and it's a huge part because it's the end consumer that needs to take the decision, right? But it's, again, it's a catch-22. The brand needs to educate, but they first need to educate themselves, and then they need to educate the customer. But then the customer thinks, of course, the brand is biased, so I need to educate myself from other aspects and other areas. So who's going, where is this education going to come from, and who's going to push it?
Yeah, so there is actually a campaign at the EU level that it's called Make Fast Fashion Out of Fashion. But it's, they usually have those great campaign, but it doesn't land with all the, with everyone, to be honest. They're quite active, but I'm not sure if I go to the streets today in Brussels, on the shopping streets, nobody knows about it. I don't think they know. So it's a lot on civil society, to be honest. And then the French government, for example, is quite active on that to educate, because there is the EcoScore initiative, legal initiative to make sure that you have a score, like a label. It goes a bit beyond than the green claims. But again, it will be like, for brands, the brands will have to communicate that. So coming back to your point, I think it's really on civil society. Governments are not really pushing on anything like this, or not getting to the end users, you know, like with the EU campaign.
Yeah. Now I was just thinking, going back and touching on what you talked about earlier about your friend starting her business, how tough do you think all this will be for smaller brands compared to larger brands? Is it linear? So if you have fewer products, you also have fewer things and fewer data to collect? Or is it maybe easier for a startup because you don't have any changes to do? You just start in the right way directly? Do you have
no baggage?
Yeah. So what's your thought? How tough is it going to be for smaller brands starting out or smaller brands that exist compared to the larger organizations that have more resources in putting people in place and putting money into systems and so forth?
Yeah, I think for startups, it might be easier for them because they will start with, you know, like, as you said,
the blank canvas,
the get-go. They will need to have lawyers with them, to be honest. So that's an extra cost as a startup. I would really tell a startup, like, get a lawyer before you start doing anything to make sure. They might get, that's my own feeling. But because they will start from the get-go saying like, okay, we need this and this and this as specs and requirements with their business partners. The business partners, if they've been in the, you know, in the industry for some time, they might be like, why are you asking this? Like, the legislation is not kicking now. It's in 2028. So why are you asking us all of that? Like, and you're a small, you know, you're a small buyer. I don't want to basically bother with you. So it might, again, it might be a bit about education and ensuring mm-hmm. that your business partners understand that. So I would put a lot of efforts into that piece for our startups. Smaller organization, the issue is that the full organization will have to understand the legislation. So you cannot delegate just to the compliance team.
Okay, I see.
The checks and stuff. So the full team will have to like say like, okay, am I understanding it right? Are we doing the right thing? What specs do we need to ask? Are we checking the right document? I think that might be a business for, you know, consultants coming in and telling you like you need to do this and this and this. So extra costs for smaller organization because I know most of them don't have a legal person internally,
no.
A compliance team, because it's not how we were set up as an industry. So I would say that's extra cost or, you know, service providers that you need to think of.
But except for the actual that they need to do it, why do you think it's important to, because we see this all the time with brands in terms of sustainability, circularity, and actually making a plan and now it will be enforced. But why do you think it's important for the full team? Because most of the time, these issues come from bottom up because the team is so invested in this and they are so passionate. Leadership counts money. Can you please talk a little bit about that?
I would say for me, it's a no-brainer because I remember like in the you cannot just say, I want to be a sustainability company and not to look into the legislation. Yeah, like this will be the massive, biggest greenwashing ever to do that. Like it's a no-go. Like I'm not even going there. It should not happen, you know. It's like if you're into sustainability, well, you have to. It's again coming back to the floor of the house. So from a sustainability business, you will have to answer your team request. And it's also a massive brand reputation issue. If you do not comply and get caught, and actually you don't have any proof of like, we try to be compliant, I don't want to be in this company. Like you will lose employees before even the shit hits the fan. And then when the shit hits the fan, like you're out of business. That's clear. Not even a question. And if you're not even a sustainable organization, that sustainability, let's say, is not your angle, well, too late. Like now you have to deal with it. As a leader, you have to integrate that in your DNA. Is as GDPR, as you were saying, it's the same level. So you have to do it. It's too bad for you if you don't believe in it.
Eventually, it's an opportunity, right? Because it's the silver lining of implementing certain things in you. It's always like that with all changes that come. You can either, you know, hide away and kind of like complain and bitch and moan about it, or you can see the hugest opportunity in the fact that it's time to move ahead quickly, implement the changes. How can you be different from all the other brands that exist? And how can you do this again in an honest and authentic way? Because I think many brands have this issue as well. Now, every brand and their grandmother is slapping sustainability on because it's the way to go from a marketing perspective. But how many actually are believing in it and are doing it because it's their core purpose, core mission to run a sustainable, and I'm not talking sustainable as in green, I'm talking as in a sustainable business operating 100 years from now and making sure that the entire supply chain is taken care of, all employers, the person that washes the floor in the factory, in the, you know, everybody's literally being considered and you have a responsibility.
But I think we really should spend some time talking about the positive effects about this, because we've been talking about how much it costs, how cumbersome it is, and all the compliance and fines and tolls.
Yeah, we like it.
But this is coming really for a reason, and it has a purpose. So, what kind of changes do we hope for? Will come after this when it's in place.
The big call has been saying that, okay, voluntary initiatives are great, but if we actually want to move the needle and we change the industry, the legislation is actually the way forward, because you're putting everybody on the same starting line. So if you think of a race, then so far there have been people that were ahead like 200 meters because they were like, you know what? I don't care about sustainability because I'm selling cheap stuff and people will buy them. And all those that really do care about sustainability, they're like, okay, we need to do this, this, this. So then rentability of the product, of the business is way less. So they were, I don't know, 400 meters behind when it comes to pure business, money, etc. So now we are like bridging the gap. Everybody will have, so those that have actually been investing so far, I think their compliance costs will be way less than the others. So then you're going back into the same starting line, and then the competition will happen. And you will see that there will be bigger changes actually happening in our industry. It's really, for me, it's like the kick in the butt we needed. And to really like say like, okay, now everybody's on the same page. Like, let's have fun. Let the game begin, actually. And really drive change.
And I like that, because until now, many brands have had sustainability as their differentiator. And it's not actually, it's something that just should be there from the, it should be the foundation. So let's talk a little bit about the, how can brands differentiate themselves now that the legislation's gonna force them to not slap on sustainability as the go-to marketing spiel, which we know every go-to ISPO, go-to whatever fair, and you see and you hear the same thing over and over. And it's actually nothing new. It's nothing like, it just should be like that. But I think this conversation ties back into the innovation, into hopefully bringing creativity back from a design perspective and from a product development and construction perspective. So I personally, I love the fact that it's forced, because I love change, because it literally forces you to think new, think outside the box, even though there is a box, but more or less you're standing on the box. You don't necessarily have to be inside the box, so you can still play around. But what do you think a differentiation could look like for companies?
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. I think it's going to be a massive advantage for innovation in a few years. And it's not only at design, it's also for manufacturers, because they would be like, okay, let's say water recycling, then how can we make sure that, and some suppliers, manufacturers are already doing that, but it's like, okay, how can we implement that all the water, like we have a closed loop for the water usage within the factory, because it will be at one point measured under the ESPR, for example, or energy usage. So you will have to think outside of the box, also to push other countries to actually allow for new legislation or to not restrict innovation when it comes to manufacturing processes. So it's, I would say it's not only at design level or at communication to consumers, but it's also the other part of the supply chain. This is going to be a massive change, and they will have to think of new stuff. They will, like chemicals, traceability, new chemicals. So it's going to be a snowball effect, and a nice one to have a nice snowman at the end of the whole process. And that's where I think it's driving. It's like, yes, it might be feels like, oh, shoot, like we need to do all that. But then it's going to bring new ideas, like, okay, we still want to sell more, be the best. We're all at the same level now. Like, what can I go? Where can I go for? And there would be some collaboration. There would be innovation. I'm sure of it. It's how it worked for the computer and printer company. They had to do arrive at the same level, and then they're all coming with new things with energy efficiency that before they wouldn't have thought of it. So that's, I would say, it's massive opportunity indeed from innovation and sustainability perspective. And we talked a lot about environmental aspects, and I think from a social aspect, the lens will be there very soon. So ensuring worker rights in supply chain, up the supply chain and down the supply chain at all level, because recycling industry will be big. So we also need to make sure that in the recycling industry, the social approach is really important.
Yeah, I love it. I think it's going to be, I'm really, really excited to see what's going. And also for us, when we work inside the brands, it's also quite interesting to see the panic, but also the solutions and how different brands tackle this in different ways, in what the focus is, and also how some that have processes and tools, and also give room for, because there will be fuck ups, right? There will be, you can't, because there's no, nobody actually knows. Nobody's done it. There's no blueprint. There's no framework. So you'll have to kind of like find your own way. But this is also the challenge. The challenge lies in making some mistakes, learning, pivoting quickly, but being this agile, constantly like on your game instead of still operating. And I think this is yet another thing that's going to happen. Businesses, especially bigger businesses, they're so used on operating like a slow tanker, but you can't. You need to be the speedboat operation now, because you need to be on your toes. One thing I want to come back to, though, to see how if we can find new ways, is the end consumer. How, because this will be how, and behavior change, because we read over and over again, yes, Jen said they believe sustainability, 82% they invest in this, but then they don't actually, when you look at other data, they actually still spend money with Shein and Zara in the fast fashion, because they have the social life to kind of play around with. So the behavior change, how do you think the legislation and the new, is there gonna be a change?
I think I'm not 100% sure, to be honest. I think customer are citizens, so the push they had towards policymakers was to say, like, we want to buy from companies that know their French, but they know their shit. They have their due diligence in place, and actually they don't want to think if your company is good or not, basically. They are like, I like this style, because we're still expressing ourselves through that. And they're like, we want to take out the bad companies, let's say, outside of the market. And then we want to make sure that what we buy it from the right legislation, the right company. When it comes to, I think, overproduction, overconsumption, it's something that is not really tackled in the through the legislation. And so changing that behavior is a bit outside. It's the second loophole, let's say. They've been a bit on unsold goods. So companies will have to report on the goods that they cannot sell. And also for textile, there will be a ban on the destruction of unsold goods. So it's pushing companies to produce less, but to consume less for customer. I don't think there is a push for that. They will have more information on the products they are buying, on the company they are buying from, but to drive them to another way of consumption, that's something that hasn't been addressed, to be honest.
And so literally what we're saying is that the legislation's put in frameworks for sustainability, but we're not at circularity level.
Yeah.
Unfortunately. Do we see that this is the next step, or they're not even thinking about that yet? Because now let's figure this out first, put this in place, and then circularity and fully circular systems, that's going to come later. Is that where we're standing right now?
I think it's how it will unfold. And there is also that big question is how can you cannot force people to buy something by law. So the freedom of choice is really important. And so if you force them to consume less, you kind of attack that freedom of choice.
I see. Okay.
So there was a bit of a debate around it. And I think this debate will continue because we haven't tackled overconsumption, as said, through legislation. So I think it's still in the pipeline, I would say. You will still have political debate around it. Yeah.
We've attacked this conversation from many different levels. But of course, in the end, it's all going to be very practical. And for the people who listen, I'm sure their thinking is, okay, now I know this is coming. I should be scared, but I need to take action. So if we were to round up this conversation, where do people go? Of course, they should come to you. So where can people find you first?
They can find us at oanapublicaffairs.eu, everything together. And one that is, okay, there you will find about us. But the one that is, the section that is really interesting for people who wants to know a bit more what it means, where we are going out, it's actually the blog. We have, so you go to oanapublicaffairs.eu and then you will see at the top corner, there is the blog section. And here you have usually explanation in easy way, not EU jargon, easy to understand what actually all those legislation means. So that I would say it's a good one. When it comes to practicalities on how to implement it, I think it's still up and coming. Haven't seen anything super like fantastic, like really like just this is the law you need to do step one, step two, step three. That's what I mean.
Because this is what goes in my mind right now. If I were a brand, this is exactly what I would need. All right.
Yeah. So that is up and coming. I know, as mentioned, EOG, so the European Outdoor Group, is working on it. Transformers Foundation has some, identification of the legislation, what it means for more suppliers. And for smaller organization, I would say look at your national industry association. They should be able to provide you with some tools. I know a lot of them are working on that, so it's more contacting the national association, either outdoor or fashion. You know, those guys will have something at one point.
And wrapping up on that, I know we touched a bit on this earlier, but if we're going to look at the lowest hanging fruit and think a bit of the, you know, the Pareto principle, the 80-20 rule, yeah. If we're attacking 20%, the 20% is going to have the biggest effect, which one would it be? Would it be then the product?
Yeah.
Or what would you say?
I would say product. I would say all recyclability, durability, recycled content. I would focus on ESPR, or on the eco-design, sorry, eco-design legislation. For me, it's like the no-brainer. If you have to focus on one or start with one, is to look into that.
And then, of course, this is also going to affect all the content that goes into the marketing. So eventually you'll have taken care of that as well, because exactly. You won't be able to bullshit. You actually have the facts and the data and the stories and there's no fluff around it.
Yeah. And because you will have done all that work, you also know where your product comes from. Who are your suppliers? Then you will have almost the first step of due diligence. So if you are like a smaller organization, but you want to have, and you have a strong sustainability identity, then you can build on that to do actually the due diligence process. So they go hand in hand, I would say. Yeah.
Absolutely. This is brilliant. I think that's it. This was quite a dense. Is there any other cover?
No, it's so much to digest. It's fantastic, and it's really good to know and be aware of what's upcoming. And as we talked about, it's coming for a reason. It has a good purpose, and I guess all of us in the industry has to go through this. But in the end, it's hopefully going to be a good thing.
And what's great, and why I love that you clarify, this is going to affect, because from conversing with some American brands, they think that, no, it's only a European thing. It is not. It's not only a European thing. It's a global thing. And if you want to be able to sell your products and source materials, whatever, from the rest of the world instead of your tiny country, then yes, this will definitely affect you, and there will need to be some changes. But again, I mean, it's all opportunities instead of, I don't like to be negative, but it's a pain in the ass, of course, but this will all lead to something good and a huge change for the industry, for the planet, et cetera, et cetera. But also it's a great thing with this industry, because it never sits still. You never get bored. It's not like, oh, yet another season. No, because there's new things coming in from left and right and up and above, and you're like thrown in the tumble dryer and it's something else. So it's exciting. That's what I want to say. That's how I want to wrap it up. So this is a huge opportunity and not something to be feared, basically. Thank you so much, Pascal, for you just sharing everything and being so transparent and so honest and, you know, giving all this information. It's phenomenal. Now we will have all the show notes and the links in the show notes so people know where to find you. And yes, a huge, huge thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's super exciting. It was my first podcast, actually. So
yes. We love that.
It's fun. It's really fun.
Potentially, I would love to have you back on to in a while, in a year. Like, where are we now? What's coming? What's new stuff that people and brands need to think about and have in consideration? So, yes, let's keep this coming.
Definitely. Let's continue the conversation.
The industry needs you and needs your offer and what you have to share. So it's fantastic.
Thank you.
Great.
Thank you so much.
Welcome.